Thank you, Rabbi Charlap. Rabbi Charlap thought I was going to possibly be upset about the words about Freud. It couldn't. I absolutely have no trouble with it. Actually, the pastoral psych guys will recognize this story, so we'll consider it chazara, those of you who took pastoral psych with me, but there are other people in the audience who haven't. There's this terrific story that was published, openly published, and I think it's a good way to start. It's a story about the Tzemach Tzedek. The Lubavitch Rebbe in 1901 became depressed. And it's amazing to me that when you think about how they didn't censor this in any way. They published his diary, Lubavitch. And it talks about how one day he became depressed. He was feeling down. It sounds like he was meeting many of the symptoms that your handouts show. And it says in the diary, he went to visit Eitzel HaRofe HaMefursam BeVienna B'Shem Freud. Pei Reish Yud Yud Dalet. Okay, when I first saw it, I couldn't believe my eyes. But this is before Freud was Freud. Before Freud developed a lot of his ideas. And he had one session with Freud. And it's a little tough to figure out exactly what Freud told him, or how much Freud charged him for that matter. But it was a one session cure. Because what Freud told him, he said, you know what your problem is? He said, your problem is that you're doing all this good work. You know, you're giving shiurim and you're writing svarim, and you're doing whatever it is that he did on a daily basis, but you're getting no feedback whatsoever. So you're feeling that you're sort of like speaking into the wilderness, that you're having no impact whatsoever. And Freud recommended that the Tzemach Tzedek get feedback from some balabatim. He said, find some balabatim and ask them, how am I doing, you know? And it doesn't say what happened, but it's clear, if you follow the diary, it's clear that within a couple of days, he went to visit an almana, and then you just keep reading it, it's clear that the depression lifted, okay? One session cure, before Freud invented a treatment that was, that would have cost a lot more and would have been, you know, 2-3 times a week laying on a couch and who knows what. But to echo what Rabbi Charlap said, I went to graduate school. It was a long time ago. It was about 30 years ago is when I finished. Went to University of Pennsylvania, which was quite a shock after I went straight from after learning in the Beis Medrash of Tar V'Das for a number of years. And when I went to Penn, what I was up against in studying graduate psychology was this tremendous, tremendous anti-religious feeling. Religion was seen in the view of Freud, who was set the tone then, as a mass obsessive compulsive neurosis. It was viewed as a crutch. Today, there's a whole new view in the field of psychology about how to treat depression, and how to view the role of religion in a way that's a total sea change. You know, even if you may say that religion is a crutch, it's look who's limping. Look who's limping without that crutch, okay? When they started to look empirically at how people who are religious differ from those who aren't, virtually every single study has shown a tremendous advantage to in terms of mental health, to religious people as compared to people who don't have that emunah. So what Rabbi Charlap was saying, it's not surprising to us, but everything that he was saying is completely consistent with the way the most recent research has been coming out, which is basically that one of the answers to dealing with some of the tough times in life, including depression, lies in tying yourself to meaning. And that's one of the things I want to say. But let me start. My colleague, Dr. Schwartz, is going to be going into detail about diagnosis and about treatment. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the treatment end of things. But I do want to make sort of about four broad points. First of all, just sort of to set the stage, let's talk about definition. And I don't want to take from Dr. Schwartz at all, but just broadly, so we know what we're talking about. Depression, the first thing that we have to know is that it's very, many people think they understand depression, because who could live life without at times feeling sad or down in the dumps? Totally normal. I don't think it's possible to live life without having a single sad day or sad moment, right? What depression with a capital D is, as opposed to just feeling depressed, is where it really takes over your life. And it takes over in your life that really is the machala. So when you have a major depressive episode, you have something that is so incredibly painful that it's hard to go on with your life as you've gone on with it before. So it's changes in mood, body, and thought. And you'll hear details later. Your packets have a very good description of what a depressive disorder. But basically, it's where you become dominated with a depressed, bad, sad mood, persistent feelings of sadness, hopelessness, irritability, which I'll talk about a little bit later. In terms of the changes in your body, you may have sleep disturbance, you may have appetite disturbance, you may also feel slowed down, like you're moving through water. And in terms of thought, you have trouble thinking clearly, so you feel like you're damaged. Your self-concept is one marked by feelings of worthlessness, maybe preoccupation with death or dying. And in those three categories, you have certain combinations, which you'll hear about later, that mean that you're either having a major depressive episode, if it starts to take over your life and impair your functioning, or an important subtype of depression, which you'll be hearing about later, is something called dysthymia, which is a lot of these symptoms, but not in a way that so impairs your functioning that you can't go on, but very important to recognize, because if you have dysthymia, it puts you at risk for developing full-blown depression later. So, and if you could catch these things early and stop a person from having recurring episodes of depression with a capital D, it could really make a difference in terms of risk later on. So I just wanted to say that just sort of to set the stage about what we're talking about. Now, why is it so important to talk about this? I was asked to give a broad overview about the topic. It's important for a variety of reasons, but in some ways what we're dealing with here, as you know, is dinei nefashos. Why is it at times a life-threatening thing? First of all, we know that in a certain percentage, there's a risk, chas v'shalom, for suicide. So severe, untreated depression. Again, it's hard for us to relate to this, but when you feel that there's no out and you feel totally helpless and hopeless about your life, at that point, there's risk of just totally giving up, okay? And that does happen in a certain percentage of people. So that's one real issue that we have to think about, so that when you're identifying somebody, those of you in the room, both the Rabbanim, future Rebbeim, or future members of the community, if you could, the eye sees only what it knows. If you could figure out how to see depression and get that person help, a few things happen. Number one, treatments nowadays are much more effective than they ever were. That's number one. Number two, the earlier you get it, most adolescent depression, for example, goes undiagnosed and untreated. 70% of adolescents with major depressive disorder, people don't know what they're looking at because adolescents are obnoxious often. And the way they show depression is they're irritable or they may be disruptive. When I was in school, they taught us there are two kinds of symptoms in kids, garlic and onion. Garlic are the kids who make everybody else miserable. Onion is where the kids are themselves are miserable. But most depressed adolescents are everything bagels. They're a mixture of garlic and onion. So the way they may show the depression is with the garlic side. They may push you away with irritability, with cynicism. There's something that goes along with major depression often called anhedonia, which is an inability to experience pleasure. So they're not fun to be around. They push others away. They push away the sources of support. So when you pull that all together, what often happens is that it's easy to miss. My Rebbe, I was zocher to have Rav Palm as my Rebbe for 5 years in Torah Vadas. He used to talk about situations like this. He said, when you see other people suffering, either with abuse or with psychiatric illness, human nature is to pull away. Human nature is to look the other way, A, because it takes a lot of energy to reach out to somebody who is suffering. It's easy to reach out to people who are clearly suffering. It's the more subtle suffering that we often have a hard time seeing. And he said, among the problems of not recognizing and not opening up your eyes to the suffering of others, he says, is you're over on the lav of lo tisalim. He says, it's halama. He says, it's no different than walking down the street and seeing somebody struggling with a load or struggling with a broken down car and pretending you don't see it. He says, the lav. He says, that's the lav that you're over when you see another person suffering with emotional distress. Okay? He says, you have to open your eyes to this. And that's what today's about. That's why I'm so happy that today's program is about what's called the common cold of psychiatry, right? It's a very, very common problem, but it's unnecessary to suffer with it today because there's such good treatments, okay? So that's why it's so important. So the first main point I wanted to make is open your eyes. Open your eyes, recognize it, look at the subtlety. Sometimes it'll show itself in addition to the symptoms of depression that are outlined in your handouts. It could be masked. It could hide itself. It could show itself with persistent stomach aches, persistent headaches, especially in men who aren't very comfortable in talking about feeling depressed, but they are comfortable in talking about feeling tired, in expressing irritability, a loss of interest in works or hobbies. And in general, they're going to present it. They're much less comfortable than women are. Why is this particularly important for this crowd? Is that there are a number of studies that have come out in the last decade that find that Jewish men are at about double the risk for depression than any other group, okay? That in general, about twice as many women as men in the world in large, about twice as many women as men are depressed, okay? But there's a one-to-one ratio in Jewish men, regardless of whether they're from, regardless of whether they're, you know, where they are on the spectrum of frumkeit, okay? I could make some bad jokes, but I won't, okay? But it is, and there's a lot of theories as to why, but it's a robust finding. It's been found in a study of over 18,000 people in this country, in a study of many thousands in England, in Israel. They keep finding the same finding. Jewish men are a group that's at a particularly high risk for depression. So in terms of lo tisalim, it's particularly fitting to reach out to all of you as future leaders or current leaders to open your eyes to this possibility. Because another important finding in terms of this part of the talk is that there's a fourfold increase in risk for death in people who are over 55 who have undiagnosed and untreated depression. What do I mean by that? If you're over 55 years old and you're depressed, your immune system is more likely to be suppressed. The way your body works to fight off illness is very different. And as a result of that, there is literally a fourfold chance that you're going to be at risk for succumbing to some kind of fatal illness, like, for example, heart attacks, etc. So that's a very, very important. We're really dealing here with life and death issues, okay? Not just suicide. It's also what it does to our immune system. Just think of what you're doing. If you open your eyes, those of you who might be rebbeim in a high school or working with kids in NCSY or assistant rabbis or future rabbis and certain current rabbis, and you identify just one adolescent who's depressed, who's looking a little bit like this pattern, and you get them help, you're literally changing the trajectory of their life in a way that will change their health status, not just change their enjoyment, not just change their avodas Hashem, because they are inextricably intertwined. You look at Rabbeinu Bachya, you look at Shari Tshuva on the Shar of Bitachon. He talks about that, he really talks about depression. He says, if you have true Bitachon, you don't get depressed. Now, that's a very tricky kind of thing, because the problem is, as we now know, that the challenge for many people is a biologically driven depression that makes it very hard to connect and find meaning. But again, when you're treating a depression properly, which a person, maybe a particular person's struggle, you're also not just saving their physical well-being, but you're also addressing their neshamas as well. Very clear. You know, we heard Rabbi Charlap's discussion, you know, of the various sources that hammer home that point. Okay, so that's the actually part of the open your eyes, take home message here is identify it, read those symptoms, think about mass depression as well, and when you see it, be motivated to reach out because it really makes a difference. That's number one. I'm ready for number two. Number two is a little bit about. I'm not going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the cultural parts. A little bit about the etiology. We're going to hear from Dr. Schwartz the theories about what causes it. We heard a little bit from Rabbi Charlap. And it's a complicated stuff. Some people have a biologically driven and maybe even a genetically driven predisposition. Other people have no predisposition, but there are tough things that happen in their lives. Multiple losses put us at risk for depression, feelings of hopelessness, feeling trapped. There are many pathways to becoming a depressed person. But let me talk a little bit about stuff that we could do about in terms of the cultural pathways, because that's important, and it was, in a way, what I was asked to talk about. In terms of cultural pathways, I wanted to talk about two issues, okay? Because we know there's some people who seem to have no genetic predisposition to depression, but become depressed because they're feeling hopeless or feeling helpless, okay? And there are things we could do about that. I'll talk about two components. Component number one is the component of affluenza. Affluenza is the finding that the highest rate of depression in the world is in wealthy adolescents. Okay, that's affluenza. It turns out that new generations there's been a rise in depression. They've been tracking depression for at least a century, and as they track it, they find that every new cohort, every new group has increased risk for depression. Now, in this room, we can understand, we're not sure what it's about, but we can understand that it's probably tied to a loss of meaning. It's probably tied to the external influences out there. It's probably tied to people who are living a more empty life. Again, those of you who have taken pastoral psychology have heard me talk about, you know, what we know is that you ask the average American adolescent entering college, what's your dream? What's number one on your mattering map in the future? What do you hope for as you're entering young adulthood? And the number one answer in 2004 was to make money. That's the dream. As recently as 1950, the number one dream was to find meaning in life. So there's been a sea change. And I can't help but believe that the rise in depression is related to that. At the same time that there was a doubling to a tripling of the standard of living in this country corrected for inflation, there was also a doubling and tripling of the depression rate and of the suicide rate. So I can't help but think that there's some connection there that, as complex as it might be, that the answer, again, lies in this room. So in terms of really making a difference, it's not just the eye seeing what it knows and being aware of it and not being over on Lotus Alim. It's also your jobs in the future as the future leaders or as the current leaders in terms of looking at some of the environmental contributors. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that if, in fact, the best antidote to depression in terms of the overall cultural issues are, A, helping children learn to find meaning, helping them connect to the spiritual, helping them connect to what matters the most. Again, as people in chinuch or people who are going into the pulpit or people who are currently there, helping people tie into that makes an enormous, enormous difference. Study after study after study shows that people who are going through the tough times in life, who have that connection to the spiritual, it's probably the best buffer. It's probably better than Prozac, okay, in terms of being a buffer against the ravages of depression. Makes sense. If you have connection and have meaning, that's what ultimately really, really gives you that kind of reason to live, and it becomes energizing. And it overrides the biological even, because meaning does override the biological. Those of you who read the best-selling nonfiction book of all time, other than the Bible, know that Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, he talked about how in his experience in the concentration camps where he was sent after he was already a psychiatrist, he saw that as soon as people gave up, they die within a couple of days. But if they could hold on to some sense of meaning, even if the sense of meaning was fantasies of nekama, or just hoping for reunification with family, they were much more likely. It didn't work for many of them, but they were much more likely to survive. So clearly, your role as connectors of people to meaning, especially in light of the particular risk of Jewish men for depression, is a crucial, crucial role. And then part of that is the affluenza. You understand the connection between materialism and depression. You take an adolescent who comes from a wealthy background, who's not tied to meaning. I'm always amazed. Sometimes I'll see on the same day a wealthy adolescent. Nothing makes them excited. They'll drive up to my office in a, sometimes a $50,000 car. They'll have the Platinum American Express card in their wallet, no limits at all. There's no in their life. And that's a sure antidote for depression very often. And then the same day, I'll see a Hasidish kid living a very isolated life in, let's say, up in Monroe or in Williamsburg. I'm not saying that there aren't problems in those communities as well. But there's a certain purity to them. There's a certain, not in, in certain cases, there's a certain excitement about even the simplest things. They'll drive up to my neighborhood in Long Island and just be excited by seeing homes. They'll be excited by the trees. There isn't that sense of, you know, magiali. And you can see why there seems to be a lower rate of depression in kids who come from those kind of backgrounds. They have a different sense of meaning, a different sense of connection, and not that sense of entitlement that basically leads to, you know, I've been there, I've done that, what's the point? Okay? So what's your role in all of that? Your role is kids do want to know, adolescents want to know about meaning. They want to know. I find that when I sit down with a group of adolescents from a variety of yeshiva high schools and talk to them about it and get them to think about what do you really want to do with your life, help them to connect to that, they become alive. It's something that speaks to their developmental stage. And again, I'm talking about adolescents so much because, again, 70% of the time their depression is not being diagnosed, and that's the time that you could really, really make a difference by stopping them from going into recurring bouts of depression. So, I mean, but obviously it's very important to diagnose it later on and earlier on as well. Okay, but that's the main second point I wanted to make. Third point, I want to talk a little bit about the stigma. I led in with it, but the stigma is so important. It's beginning to change, but not enough. There's no reason, given what we know now about the biologic underpinnings of depression, there's no reason why people should have to be embarrassed about it. There's the issue of shidduchim, which obviously is something that people have to think about. If somebody's on medication, at what point do they tell somebody they're going out? What are the statistics about recurrence of depression, which becomes an issue for people? It turns out that 50 to 60% of people who have a major depressive episode can be expected to have a second episode. Those who have two have a 70% chance for a third, and those with three have a 90% chance of having a fourth. That, coupled with the higher rates of Jewish men, is something to think about. But again, the earlier you get it, the earlier the treatment, there's some evidence, the better the prognosis. So, and we'll hear more about that later. But in terms of the stigma, there's a lot that we all could do. A Yomiyun like today is very, very important. Very important, because, again, it's the beginning of not just identification, but opening it up. As you talk about these things and you realize that it's no different than any other kind of illness, it could free people up to be more comfortable to talk about it, to name the monster, and to go for help for it instead of just suffering silently with it or just missing it, okay? So that's the third main point I wanted to make. You know, there's a lot of evidence that giving people a chance to just understand what's going on with them may be half the refuah. Why is it that the Tzemach Tzedek had such a drastic change after just one meeting with Dr. Freud, okay? It's in part because he probably normalized it for him. He probably gave him a little bit of hadracha. There's something called the chickenpox analogy. The way the chickenpox analogy goes is like this. Imagine two people who have a child with chickenpox. First case, it's the fourth child. The older three had chickenpox, and their next door neighbor and best friend is a pediatrician. Second case, same level severity chickenpox. Exact same level severity. But it's an only child. The parents never saw chickenpox before, and they live in a rural area with no access to medical care. In the first case, it's no big deal. Maybe a little bit of a pain in the neck, but no big deal. You've been there, you've done that, you know exactly what the course is. You probably don't lose any sleep over it unless your kid with chickenpox wakes you up, but you're not going to really worry that much about it. Second case is the same stressor, but it's terrifying. Will my child live? Will my child die? Is he going to be permanently disfigured or not? Do I let him scratch the pox? What do I do about this? It's terrifying. What's the difference between the psychological reactions in case one and case two? It's knowledge. And again, that's why just having this knowledge about diagnosis, knowledge about the way this plays out in our community, and knowledge about treatment resources is the equivalent of making that second case more like the first case. It's very, very powerful. Chazal tell us, right, there's the machlokas in Shas on the Pasuk and Mishlei of Daga Belevish Yashchena, right? So there's a machlokas where it's Chad Amar Yashchena Midato. If you have a worry, dampen it down. V'chad Amar Yasichena Lacherim. The other man Damar says that talk it out with somebody. Find somebody and talk it out, okay? And there are different coping styles and different ways of dealing with it. And what we know is, it's interesting, the three times in the Gemara that this machlokas is cited, there's nobody who says, oh, we paskin like this or like that. You have to be the samach of Hesach Hadas and dampen it down and distract yourself. Or you have to be the sin of Yasichen Alacherim and talk it out. Nobody says that. Nobody says that. Because there's a recognition, as psychologists will tell us today, that in dealing with the tough times in life, there's no one way to deal with the tough times in life, okay? Some people will deal by talking it out. Other people just need help in distracting themselves. In fact, a part of treatment that is very important includes teaching people how to distract themselves so they don't get caught in the quicksand of self-pity. So there's room for the Yashchena Midato, there's room for the Yasichena Lacherim, but in terms of that piece, I just wanted to focus on don't get judgmental. There are many different treatments for depression. The most common you'll be hearing about soon. But what I wanted to end with is wanted to end with just sort of a summary on what you could do for somebody who you know is depressed, and then end with the story, okay? And then I'll have, that's my allotted time, was still about 10:45. First, let's talk a little bit about what you could do. Common sense stuff, but sometimes it helps to make common sense recommendations. Number one, most important thing you could do, again, is to just get them to somebody who could do an appropriate diagnosis and treatment. Even if it's just to send them to an internist sometimes, Dr. Schwartz will talk about when it makes sense to refer them to a psychiatrist. Most prescriptions for antidepressant medication in this country happen to be written by primary care physicians, but you'll hear about when the first stop should be a trip to the neighborhood psychiatrist, and when the first stop should be just to the internist, especially to rule out physical causes, which you'll be hearing about. But just having them go for help, having them, encouraging them to stick with it. There's a Jewish disease that I don't think is nearly as strong in other cultures. My friends who are doctors tell me that when they see, let's say, an Italian patient, and they'll make a recommendation. It could be, you know, your arm has to be amputated. The Italian patient will say, okay, doc, I trust you. You know, not get a second opinion. Just go on. Go completely along with whatever the doctor says. There's tremendous kavod for in the Jewish community. I don't know whether they'll accept your recommendation after a seventh or eighth opinion. And they'll go and they'll daven over it. They'll do the research. And it's good. There's a good part to it, but there's also a tendency in the treatment of depression for people in our community, even more so in the from community, I think, than in the less actively observant part of the community, to be skeptical, to change doctors before they give chances for the treatments to work. Sometimes it takes a couple of months, and we get very impatient. And very often, you have to fool around a little bit with what medication is going to work, what therapy is going to work. Again, in keeping with that Dagablev, Ish Yashchena Machlokas, one size doesn't fit all, and what works for one person isn't necessarily what's going to work for another person. And sometimes the best thing you could do for a depressed person who's one of your friends or congregants or talmidim is just push for them if they have somebody who's good, who has a good reputation, to stick with it and be patient. Many medications take a couple of weeks to a couple of months to work. Very often there have to be a fine-tuning, which you'll be hearing about later. So recommendation number one in terms of how to help is get them to the diagnosis, and recommendation number two is get them to stick with it, although obviously if they're not getting better, then of course you push them to get a second opinion. You know, if you have a depression that's not getting better after a couple of months, maybe Dr. Schwartz will tell us at one point you should do something about it. Very often, if you have an adolescent, if you're a Rebbe in a high school or you have an adolescent, make sure that they know that you may have to chaser with them about the dangers of mixing alcohol with antidepressant medications, okay? There's some real dangers there. There have been some horrible tragedies with that. And that connection between substance and abuse and depression is another reason why you can't be over in Lotus Alim. We know that on average, if you have an adolescent with depression, within 4 years, if that depression is not treated, the child will start turning to substances to self-medicate. So they'll get themselves drunk, they'll get high as a way of treating their own depression. So we have to get them our own ways that are much healthier in terms of avoiding that pain through an early referral. Next, offer emotional support. Listen carefully. It's not as simple as saying, come on, shape up already, you know? Life is much more complicated than that. Okay, you could offer hope is very important. Name the monster, giving them a chance to feel heard and understood without necessarily, many of you are used to poskening, right? You're used to black and white, to giving answers. You can't always give an answer for this. But just being there and listening, even in silence, just being there is enormously helpful to somebody who's depressed, who's often so isolated and alone. Obviously, never ignore remarks about suicide. It sometimes becomes easy, again, to look the other way when that's happening, but just don't ignore it, because it could really mean that, I mean, you never know. Sometimes it could be a call for help, but sometimes it could be, you know, almost everybody who does end up ending their lives gives many, many clues beforehand. So again, and I hear often that those clues, sometimes it's so painful that we do unconscious looking the other way. Activity planning, and then I'll start to wrap this up. Activity planning is where it turns out the research shows that just getting active, that not staying in your room and sleeping, even if it means going to Minion once a day, or even if it means going out for a walk, finding one thing a day that'll give you mastery, one thing a day that'll give you pleasure. If you help somebody do that, there's some very compelling research that shows that it's as predictive of recovery as medication. Okay? So that's a simple thing that every Rav could do, every community leader could do. It's a common sense thing, and you get them to do it systematically. And sometimes you could be the one doing it. You could go to their dorm room and schlep them out to Minion if they let you. You don't do it against their will. Anything that makes them feel hopeless or helpless is going to make it worse, okay? But activity planning is another thing you could do. Never accuse them of faking illness or of laziness or expect them to snap out of it. And just keep on remembering that the hope is not falsely based. It's obviously in the hands of Hashem, but the refuah is far, far more common than it ever was. The treatments you'll be hearing about later really are to the point that the vast majority of people who stick with various treatments, one treatment or another, even for the most severe depression, is likely to work. Let me end with a story and maybe a little bit of a Dvar Torah. The story goes like this. Think of many stories, but the toughest part about ending a talk is to just choose one. But I'll tell you a story of somebody I worked with who was quite depressed. And again, remember, there are many pathways to depression. In this case, it was a young man who was being raised by parents who were wonderful, loving people, but happened to be very difficult. They were concentration camp survivors. This was an only child. They poured everything into this young man. He felt he was constantly disappointing them. He wasn't living up to the bumper sticker of the family. He wasn't living up to their expectations of him. And he was feeling more and more hopeless. Almost everybody, what's underneath their depression is somehow that feeling that you're locked in a box, and no matter what you do, you can't get out of it because you try and you just can't. And I saw him shortly after the patira of the second parent. He had lost both parents, okay? And he was incredibly depressed. He was filled with guilt, but mostly with anger. He said, you know, I'm never going to have the parents I wanted. Never going to have the parents I wanted. So he was feeling totally trapped, and he had a major depressive episode, okay? And he was on medication, but it just wasn't doing the trick enough. And I went into great detail with him about his anger at his parents. And we talked about what he found toughest was that if his father or mother were getting angry at him, they would constantly, constantly hold on to it. So if he did the slightest thing wrong, they wouldn't talk to him for sometimes months at a time. They wouldn't let go of their anger. And he was also stuck in that quicksand, and that was a big chunk of what was keeping him stuck. That and the loss of knowing that he's never going to have the parents that he hoped he'd have, because after their death, he knew that wouldn't happen. There's a pasuk that some of you have heard me talk about before. It's an incredible pasuk. It's kamayim panim el panim, kein leif ha'adam, right? Saying that human emotions are similar to the reflection of our face when we look down in the water. So you look down in a pond, and you see your face being reflected back. And I won't go into all the different Divrei Chazal that teach us this, but basically it's been used in this way. That if you're angry and upset at somebody and feeling hopeless about your relationship with them, and you're locked in it, you just let go of your anger. You forgive them. You'll almost always find that as your heart lets go of your anger, and what you're reflecting back to them is not anger, but is forgiveness, that suddenly things start to get better with them, and they start to treat you in a way that you've always dreamed about. And I heard a beautiful thought that the Bali Musar have taught us about this pasuk. The thought is that, why is that analogy so helpful? That analogy is so helpful because in part, what that metaphor is about is the following. If you look at your reflection in the water, your face is distorted. The only way to be able to see yourself accurately is to bend down. Okay? If you bend down and look into the water, suddenly you see your face as it really is. So what the Bali Musar say is that when you're locked into a struggle with somebody, the answer sometimes is to bend down. The answer is to divest yourself of your egocentrism. The answer is to try to see it through their eyes. Try to see it through their perspective. And when you do that, you'll be able to let go of your anger. You'll be able to let go of your hurt. And what will get bounced back to you will be exactly what you really want. And we talked about this one day. This was a yeshiva guy who was very interested in this kind of thinking, and it's totally consistent with psychology, obviously far wiser, far deeper, but it made sense. It made sense. And he started to keep a diary, and he started to try to really work on seeing things through his parents' eyes. And we went through it. He said, you know, they were adolescents in the concentration camps. They didn't know how to parent. Their parents were killed by Hitler before they really got to know them. They didn't have a normal life. They loved him. What they were doing from love. And when they'd hold on to the angers, you don't get angry at a stranger. You get angry at somebody you love. And he gradually came to the point that he was able to stoop down, able to view things through the prism of their eyes. And as he did that, he gradually, I'm not saying that it was a miracle cure right away, but his depression started to lift. He went to their kever, he asked for mechila, he imagined giving them mechila. He gradually came to the point that he really started to feel at peace and feel that he could move on, and his depression lifted. And today, this happened a while ago. He really is. I'm still in touch with him. He's doing beautifully, Baruch Hashem, okay? So that's the bottom line message. The bottom line message is there's no one pathway to dealing with depression. What we're all arguing for today is that you, first of all, keep your eyes open. Try to know the symptoms when they're obvious and when they're not so obvious. Think about the Torah's charge to us about lo tisalim. Number two, try to address the stigma. Try to address the secrecy. Try to help people name the monster by realizing there's nothing to be embarrassed about. And we have a special achrayas as leaders of the community to reach out to people because it makes an enormous difference in terms of the long-term trajectory of their lives. And ultimately, number three is that there's tremendous, tremendous wisdom and power. The most powerful medicine is what you all have to offer. The most powerful medicine for depression, unlike Freud, okay, is the meaning that comes with the true Jewish life. And as long as we keep those messages in mind, may we all be zocha to be the agents of helping people who are in pain and reaching out to people who are silently suffering. Thank you.